Welcome to the New Books Network.
New Books in Southeast Asian Studies is sponsored by the ANU Southeast Asia Institute, the Griffith Asia Institute, the New York Southeast Asia Network, the Nordic Institute of Asian Studies, and the Sydney Southeast Asia Centre.
Welcome everyone to New Books in Southeast Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Patrick Jory. I teach Southeast Asian history at the University of Queensland, Australia, and I'm co-host of this channel. Within the social sciences and the humanities, international research on Burma or Myanmar studies tends to lean towards political science and Buddhist studies investigations of the country, or what some people have called the soldiers or monks approach to Burmese scholarship. The political situation within the country has also restricted the access that foreign researchers have had to the country and has shaped the type of research that international scholars choose to research and the grant agencies are willing to fund. As a result of this, our understanding of Burmese society and culture is comparatively weak. Now, Jane Ferguson has tried to tackle this problem in her highly original study of the history of the Burmese film industry. Her book paints a very different picture of Burma to the one we're used to. The book depicts Burma as an outwardly oriented, internationally connected place, the vibrant and creative movie industry, talented film directors, packed cinemas, movie stars, and even a Burmese version of the Academy Awards. Today, I'm talking to the book's author, Jane Ferguson. Jane is Associate Professor in Anthropology at the ANU College of Asia and the Pacific at the Australian National University, where she teaches Southeast Asian history and anthropology. Thanks so much, Jane, for coming on New Books in Southeast Asian Studies to talk about your wonderful new book.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me. I'm delighted to be here.
First, they say you can't judge a book by its cover, but I love the cover of your book. For anyone who's listening to the podcast and hasn't seen it, please Google the title of the book to see the cover. It evokes an image of Myanmar, which is very hard to imagine today.
Yeah, it does. It's actually, I'd say it's one of the sexiest academic books I've ever seen, if you can judge a book by its cover. You've got Win U. He's considered the James Dean or the Elvis Presley of Burmese cinema, and he's, you know, straddling this Honda motorbike, and he's wearing a Hawaiian-style shirt and hot pants. And then Kim Tan U is wearing the woman on the back. She's also looking kind of demurely into the camera. But it's a fun pick, and it's a vibrant one, and it's something that's quite evocative on its own. And University of Hawaii Press, the layout, they did a terrific job with the cover.
Could I start off by asking you a historian's question? You've got a foot, as it were, in both camps, history and anthropology, but this book is essentially a history of Burmese film. Could I ask you why you wanted to write a book about the history of Burmese film rather than do perhaps an anthropological study?
First of all, it's dealing with a period that, you know, the film industry from 1920 to 1980. And I got interested in the topic for anthropological reasons, because when I was doing fieldwork in a Shan village from 2004 to 2007, my Shan interlocutors, they told me stories reminiscent of the film industry of those years. They used to go to outdoor cinemas in the 1970s, or they'd go to cinemas in urban Burma, places like Mandalay or Taungji or even Yangon. And it was from their memories and their fond memories for the Burmese cinema that I got interested in that. And it was also because, you know, as an anthropologist and somebody who's very much interested and who's very passionately engaged with ideas of history, you know, anthropology informs the kind of questions that you can ask about history, thinking about what daily life was really like for people, how was it organized along different ideas of culture, gender, class, nationality, these sorts of things. So, and then also just being oriented towards, you know, what's an interesting story to tell? What kind of stories are we missing out when we look at history through different lenses? So anthropology can ask history interesting questions in the same way that history can ask anthropology very interesting questions.
Can we talk about sources for a minute? One of the remarkable things about this book is its use of a huge number of Burmese language source materials to write the history. It's really very impressive. Can you tell us about how you went about the research for this book?
Yeah, well, thanks. It was a very roundabout thing. I've been working on it for about 2 decades now, gradually accumulating materials here and there. But originally, when I was doing my fieldwork and finding out that Shan people, even Shan insurgent soldiers who were opposed to the military government and wanted to seek ethnic autonomy, they still had fond memories of Burmese pop culture. They would talk about these old movies, or they would sing these songs from Burmese rock, and even Burmese film songs. So then I naively thought, like, okay, this is really fascinating to learn because it's part of people's everyday lives and important to them. And I thought that, okay, when I get back to write my dissertation, I'll check and look for the secondary research about Burmese cinema in order to finish my dissertation talking about Burmese culture through Shan eyes, as it were. But then there was so little research, and this is the first English language book about Burmese cinema. So I realized I'd have to piece together what I could learn about Burmese cinema from either websites or Burmese sources. Because when I went to Yangon and started asking around at the book markets or in bookshops, there was a huge amount of literature in Burmese, Burmese film magazines, Burmese theses, Burmese history books, biographies of participants. The industry is massive. The publishing industry is massive. And so it made me start to piece together the history using all of these Burmese sources, and the majority of which are not systematically organized into a single archive. So, you know, it was me learning about it piecemeal as well. And I do my best to cite, and I cite everything, every source that I've used, but also acknowledge there are plenty, much more out there that I haven't read yet.
Another challenge that you discuss in the book is the limited number of Burmese films that have actually survived from the earlier period. How many of these older films have survived?
That's something that's a primary challenge is, how do you find your sources? How do you find your films to watch, to analyze? And I calculated, and this was based on release statistics, that between 1920 and 1980, there were about 2,600 Burmese films that made it to the cinemas. And out of that number, 2,600, and this is the black and white era. So these are all the black and white films. The industry didn't convert fully to color until the mid 1980s. And also television didn't start until 1979, 1980. So you've got these films. But then out of that 2,600, the films that survive as films or as motion pictures, there's only about 415 or so. And so even the National Film Archive is part of the Myanmar National Library. Of the film, celluloid film prints, they only have about 12 of that era. The 415 films, those are ones that exist on or were converted to magnetic tape. As anybody who's been to Burma will know that on Sunday, every Sunday, they show films on Myanmar TV from this era. And those were films that had been converted to magnetic tape to be shown on television. So that helped preserve them. In the early days, the days of silver nitrate, and part of it is just a hazard of the medium. Silver nitrate deteriorates quickly. If it's not stored in temperature controlled facilities, it sticks together, it fuses, it gets moldy. It's really not a suitable medium for tropical climates to begin with. It's just really finicky stuff. So it deteriorates. And then also silver nitrate, that, you know, for a country, for a context with a lot of economic problems, preserving, you know, let alone restoring old films, like to restore an entire feature length film costs about $80,000. So the massive cost of restoring an old film, but finding a film that's in good enough condition to restore. But silver nitrate, there were times when if you put an old film through chemical wash, you can extract the silver and recycle the silver and sell it. So there's an economic incentive to recycle or to harvest old films. So the story disappears, but you can get the silver and resell it. Also, there were so many old film companies that would only make 3, 4, 5 prints of a single film. They wouldn't keep a duplicate simply because they would distribute one to every major city, or they'd have a contract for that. So there weren't very many copies to begin with. Other issues, like in 1950, the biggest film company, A1, the equivalent of kind of the Hollywood, the MGM of Burma, they had a film storage center. They had a fire in it. So a lot of film copies were destroyed then. And then also, there hadn't been a single centralized archive for all of the films. There hadn't been a government investment in a single archive for all of them until much later. You know, it was Myanmar TV, the advent of BBS, the Burmese broadcasting system, and that was able to get these copies and transfer them to magnetic tape. And that there were so many small independent film companies that, you know, they would keep copies of their films at their warehouses, and they, by the Ne-Win socialist era, would they want to surrender their copies to a government agency? So there's reasons that are material, economic, and bureaucratic that these old films don't exist anymore. And another point too, like the early German films, those are gone as well. So it's certainly not unique to Burma, but the reasons they don't exist are connected to Burmese history too.
I was quite surprised to learn that Myanmar actually has a pretty old film industry going back to 1920 at least. How did the Burmese film industry get going?
Yeah, well, the reason it got going, well, it was part of the colonial economy, and that they had traveling tent showmen coming through Burma in the first decade of the 1900s, and they put up sailcloth cinemas to show short reels on those. And also because Burma has a huge indigenous entertainment industry in the form of stage shows, comedies, puppet shows, that it's long been noted that they have this propensity towards temple events. So popular theater, the cinema is almost the natural heir to popular theater and puppet shows. So when they started to build brick and mortar cinema halls in 1910, 1911, they would add short reels as part of that, but they'd still have live entertainment as well. There you'd have variety shows or you'd have cinema going together. And by the 1910s, when there started to be longer feature films, and then also bear in mind too that Rangoon was a really bustling port city with a really vibrant colonial economy, lots of migrants elsewhere, people that were working for wages, and then also people who had money to spend on entertainment. And so it would also become a center for popular entertainment in the form of film. And they'd have cinema hall bands that had either, depending on the character of the audience, if they were Europeans or if they were South Asians or if they were Burmese, they would change the accompanying band depending on who the audience was. So you could watch a Charlie Chaplin film, for example, and have it accompanied by a Burmese court ensemble, as it were. And there's amazing stories, like they would advertise films and say that, oh, we have the violinist in the band is from Goa. That would be a big deal because like the Goan violinists, they had learned how to read Western notation. So they were skilled at playing the Western scores. So part of it is just that it was a cosmopolitan city to begin with. And so that the cosmopolitan entertainment would come along with it.
In this early period of Burmese filmmaking, what are some of the main themes and storylines of Burmese movies produced at that time?
In the early years, there would be love triangles, there'd be action, adventure. And during the silent era, you'd have a special language that would be more about making gestures than something that would be conversation-based. You know, you'd have intertitling. In other words, there'd be a frame with some text to explain the context of the story or to tell the story that was going on. But a lot of Charlie Chaplin style, Buster Keaton style adventures, people stealing cars and going on mad chases, things like that. A lot of physical comedy. And in some ways, a lot of the physical comedy was, for the Burmese movies, was drawn upon the Burmese Anyan style comedies as well. So you'd have joker types. And also when people went to the cinema, and this is one thing that I appreciated learning about reading the biography of one of the cinema hall piano players, was that there would be a whole lot of audience interaction, not just with the screen, but also with the people in the band. So there was the Burmese equivalent of a Zorro character. He was called Bo Wa. And, you know, he's like swashbuckling, you know, horse riding this character. And Abdullah, the drummer in the cinema hall bands, if the bad guys were about to pounce on Bawa, he would shout out to the screen like, Bawa, look out behind you. And then they would pounce on him. And then the audience would erupt in laughter because it was a very kind of Rocky Horror Picture style form of interaction. So the ways that there was this constant banter between the audience and the band and the screen really made it into a unique and special social experience.
Another thing I found really interesting was your discussion of filmmaking in the British colonial period. Although there was a censorship board, Burmese film seems to have been relatively free from government control. And as a result of this, it was quite experimental and quite creative. What kind of films did the Burmese film industry produce at this time?
It's an interesting question because there's always been this concern among governments of the nefarious influences of popular culture. And that kind of concern often is a conservative and can be religious based, but it really fails to understand the connection between what people see on the screen and then their actual behavior. Like how many people can watch a crime movie and it doesn't automatically cause crime? There's that kind of social connection between the texts. But there starts to be a lot of reports, and there was a very high rate of crime in colonial Burma compared to elsewhere in the British Empire. So whether that's a result of social tensions or the form of data gathering and policing, we could question to what extent those are related. But also that, for example, the Film Censor Board in colonial Burma also included local Burmese people as part of a temperance movement as well. And there were a lot of, we wouldn't call them Tipitaka thumpers, but people who were really concerned about the authenticity or the kind of Buddhism in decline that was a concern in the colonial era. And for example, in Burma, they'd receive a lot of Indian films. And one of these was the Falca film called Buddha Dev, A History of Buddha's Life. It ended up being censored in Burma, even though a lot of people would surely go and see it. But the censor board listed three reasons. One, that Buddha should not be played by a real person. Two, that in the Indian film Buddha Dev, Buddha did not have a big enough entourage. So I guess they needed to hire more extras to portray it accurately. And then third, the Burmese censor board argued that the Buddha in Buddha Dev looked too Indian and not Burmese enough. So Buddha not having the proper ethnic features for the context was seen as a problem, regardless of the provenance of the Lord himself. But how Burmese filmmakers were creative, which I find fascinating as well, was that they would incorporate the typical love triangle, the typical action movie, but they also made quite a number of films that were based on local folklore. And then later on, when sound movies came about, that they would be animated and they would talk about the myth of Ushinji, Sangdoshin. This is the harp player. So it's a Mon folktale about the history of a particular knot. And then it's animated for the film. So they put a lot of local concerns and, you know, local stories using the most sophisticated media of the time in order to retell those stories. So again, I'm interested in the kinds of stories that people would tell, the creative representations of the stories.
It's really interesting to read that in the 1930s, as Burmese nationalism was on the rise, even despite colonial censorship, the Burmese film industry started to make films with nationalistic themes.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, here's the other aspect of, I mean, it's an interesting historiographic question as well, because by principally using Burmese sources to tell this story, and especially Burmese sources that were published during the socialist years or later, the way they reflect on the origins of cinema is they'll talk about the fathers of Burmese cinema and that they were people who wanted to preserve authentic Burmese culture in the face of colonial domination. And so in a lot of ways, some of the Burmese film history is shoehorned to fit the arc of nationalist history. So the films that do have ideas about nationalism or do have ideas about Bama fighting back against foreigners, those are given a lot more, shall we say, airtime in the Burmese history discourse, because it seems that, yes, there were filmmakers that were nationalists. Or, for example, there was a film that was made in 1935 called Japan Yinthwe, a Japanese daughter, which talked about a fictitious trip where two Burmese aviators would do a nonstop flight between Tokyo and Rangoon. And for some, they say it planted the idea that someday an independent Burma would have its own air force. So there's aspects of military nationalism as well during Burmese era colonial films. And for example, the national anthem is derived from a film song from the 1930s. And there were plenty of examples where they saw film as a way to present a Burmese form of modernity and a Burmese form of cultural pride. And so there's plenty of connections that can be made for nationalist arguments there.
So the war breaks out in Southeast Asia in 1941, and the Japanese invade and occupy British Burma. How did the Japanese occupation affect filmmaking in Burma at that time?
For the most part, local film production ground to a halt. That the cinema halls were taken over. For example, one cinema hall in Sancheong was renamed Sakura, and they started to show Japanese samurai movies. Other cinema halls that continued to operate as cinema halls would just show older movies as they could. So in some of the urban areas that could still have some remnants of pop culture, or, you know, they still had films going, or they would be replaced by live theater, local sketches as well. The Japanese government did make use of cinemas for propaganda purposes. And some of the popular film stars, the ones who were affiliated with A1, and then also, this is the other aspect of the film industry, the middle classes were very well connected during the colonial era. And the students, like university students and the student activists, were also connected or had friends in the film industry. So A1 studio that I mentioned, some of their stars were closely connected with Aung San and UNU and the people who would become the political leadership after the Second World War. So some of them actually fought on the side with Aung San.
Burma finally gains its independence in 1948, and it seems like a new era opens up for the Burmese film industry. It's like a golden age of Burmese film. The government starts to provide financial support for the industry, but in return for encouraging filmmakers to produce films that support a nation-building agenda. Can you tell us how the film industry responded to this new political era?
They were given certain instructions that, okay, we have this Union of Burma coming together. We want a film industry that on the one hand is cosmopolitan, but also kind of fights back against the tide of the giants like Hollywood. The government acknowledged that by importing Hollywood films, they were making a ton of money off of the import duty, but then also ticket sales. But they wanted to preserve a Burmese film industry, partly for these ideological reasons. And so they made laws saying that Burmese cinemas would have to play Burmese movies a minimum of 60 days out of the year. So they guaranteed a market for the cinema industry. And also they helped to foster connections by upgrading technology, encouraging Burmese filmmakers to go overseas to study. They had film study trips or buying technology. Actually, buying technology had been part of the industry from the very beginning. I mean, it was in the 1930s that Burmese filmmakers went to Japan to buy sound on film production equipment and learn studio engineering in order to make sound on film, to make talkie movies. And in the 1950s, and also it's important to remember too that Burma had arguably the biggest media scene in Southeast Asia around the 1950s. So people were consuming magazines, newspapers, novels, radio, records, all of that. So it was a huge blossoming time for the film industry. And then also just to have Burmese politicians in the saddle politically meant that these Burmese politicians that they'd been working with previously, they would be apt to want to support the film industry.
By this time, you write that the audience for Burmese films is really quite large. About how many people are watching movies each year in Burma?
Well, I was only able to get, like, for the parliamentary democracy period, so that's from 1948 until 1962, that on average, it was actually by the late 60s I was able to get, or the 60s I was able to get statistics. This was based on bums in seats at cinemas, so this isn't including the outdoor traveling cinemas. But on average, every Burmese person by the late 60s was watching 7 movies annually. So, you know, you can imagine for somebody who lives in the city and maybe goes to 1 or 2 movies a month, there'd be people out in the countryside, you know, however many, not seeing any movies. And even during the Ne Win socialist period, viewership statistics actually went up about 40%.
Now, of course, by this time, the Cold War is on in earnest, and Burma, even though it's trying to steer a neutralist path, is influenced by the ideological clashes of the Cold War. You have a fascinating chapter in the book where you write about how first the CIA and later the Soviet and Chinese governments start to take an interest in the Burmese film industry by providing funding and various other forms of support.
Yeah, it's a really complicated era because, you know, UNU had characterized the country as a tender gourd caught in between cactuses, that Burma's neutralism policy is really second to none, as it were. When I lecture about Southeast Asian history, when I have students of Indonesia in the room, and I say that Burma was so non-aligned, it dropped out of the non-alignment movement. And the Indonesian students will be like, oh, that's hardcore non-aligned. And especially during the 1950s, I mean, bear in mind, it's a government that came in already having sympathies with a socialist form of rule or socialist economy or socialist values. So in some ways, if they could get development assistance from wherever or whoever they could cultivate as friends, they would do so. And the economy already being largely oriented, well, because of the British colonial experience, but towards the American film industry in particular, I would say in the 1950s, the single institution where most Burmese filmmakers went was the University of Southern California. Quite a number of them had done degrees at USC because that was the place to go to study film. But also some went on study tours to Moscow, for example. Burma had an interesting alliance with Yugoslavia in the 1950s. And also this is because of UNU organizing for the Chinese leadership to be able to go to the Bandung conference, that, you know, there were a number of study tours of Burmese filmmakers that went to China. And China during the 1950s imported a few Burmese films and then dubbed them into Chinese as examples of here are some other Asian peasant societies. Again, the Chinese government was only interested in the films that depicted peasant life. They were less interested in Burmese in nightclubs dancing the tango.
At the same time, this is the golden age of Hollywood, and Burma, like pretty much everywhere around the world, is also influenced by Hollywood film, its styles, its actors, its storylines, and so on. How deeply was Burmese cinema influenced by Hollywood at this time?
Yeah. I mean, it's fascinating too, because this was something that I laid out from the beginning. Like, you know, how do you choose what films to look at, you know, when you're talking about an industry that produced 2,600 films across a 60-year period? It's such a massive subject matter. And some would say, oh, you should study ones that are really particular and really original to that particular context, and then automatically leave out the films that are remakes of Hollywood movies. But I wanted to study all of them because looking at these Burmese remakes, it offers a really interesting bellwether to see how Burmese directors and actors recrafted and remade these existing films to orient them more towards the Burmese cultural context or towards Burmese audiences. So I go through one particular film. It's a thriller from 1947. It's a Hollywood movie called Nora Prentice. It's a love triangle story. But in the early 1950s, it was also remade in Bollywood called Sholay. And then in 1957, the story was remade in Burma called Dr. Aung Jaw Oo, and then starring a cast of Maung Maung Ta, he's the hero, and then the sexy nightclub singer slash temptress is played by Shan actress Mary Mien. And in many of the scenes, there's a whole lot of blocking where you can tell that they've taken many cues from the Hollywood movie and basically just translated some of the dialogue. But then the other parts that are added in that didn't exist in the previous film give me pause and think, like, okay, there's this tango scene in the beginning. Why would they have a tango scene? What's Burmese about the tango? And actually, thinking about it, well, Maung Maung Ta, the actor, he's an accomplished ballroom dancer. They want to showcase his skills, or they want to show that this is a sophisticated nightclub and Burmese people know how to do the tango because that's a beautiful and cosmopolitan and fun thing to showcase.
There's a gender theme that runs through the book. How were Burmese women involved in the Burmese film industry? And how were they represented in Burmese film?
Yeah, it's an interesting question because, I mean, it goes back to what I was talking about earlier, the way in which a lot of cinema history, the way it's written about in Burmese, will talk about the fathers of Burmese cinema and really focus on the male directors as being the locomotive that pulls along the cars of the cinema nationalist train, as it were. But there are differences regionally as well. Like, for example, in early Burmese cinema, the people who would play the female stars, they were tended to be upper class women or women who were established theater performers. They were singers, they were dancers. So they were stars in their own right before becoming film stars. Whereas, you know, Burma and India, they'd had well-connected economy to begin with, and especially so during the colonial period. Indian cinema differs in that the first Indian film, the person who played a woman was actually a man. It was considered déclassé for a woman to appear on the silver screen in the early years. And so they would either have Eurasians or prostitutes play the female parts in the early Indian cinema, whereas Burma did not have that hang up about women in the public sphere. So there's an interesting cultural contrast between early Burmese cinema and Indian cinema. But then also, cinema is really interesting in terms of evidence for women's consumer power during the colonial period, because women constituted a huge segment of the Burmese audiences. And this is noted in the surveys from 1928. As well, that, you know, women had the time and the money to go and see the movies, and they chose to do so. And other aspects as well throughout the industry, like if you only look at the biographies of the male directors, you might think the industry is solely controlled by men. But the movies they were directing were often based on novels that were written by women. So the stories are coming from women authors. And also women were involved not only in every phase of the production of movies, there was actually, they call them a camera min, which means like, okay, sounds like a Burmese appropriation of cameraman, but min also means king. So I'm not sure which one it is, but there was an early woman camera min. And again, women were active writers. Some were screenwriters, even though, again, the majority of directors were men.
And when we think of movies, of course, we think of movie stars. You write that one of the biggest stars of Burmese cinema in this post-independence period was a certain Miss Shanghai Mary Mint. And one of the interesting things about her was that she's not an ethnic Burma, but actually a Shan. It's an amazing story. Can you tell us?
Yeah, I mean, she is a really fascinating character because she became famous in the early 1950s. She got her start in about 1948. So she's a post-World War II star. And she was born in near Namdo, which is way in the north of Shan State, so close to Yunnan province in China. I'm pretty sure her family was middle class or had Chinese connections, because during World War II and after, she had moved to Shanghai to live with an aunt and had studied dancing there and, you know, some other crafts. So not somebody who was busy working in the rice fields, as it were. And she had participated in a beauty contest in Shanghai as well. And after moving back to Burma after the Second World War, she was interested in the pop culture industry and wanted to become a film star, as it were. She had these presentation skills. And interestingly, in the Burmese sources that I read, some of the directors had said, no, you can't become a film star because your accent is too far off. And it gave me pause, because it's like, well, a lot of the films were silent films, so what does your accent have to do with anything? But she did get theater roles, so, you know, she was able to work on that. And then when she did start playing in Burmese films, she still has a bit of the Shan accent, but that's part of the allure, that she was not a Shan person from the hills, not a Shan peasant, as it were, but a Shan beauty queen who had won a prize at a beauty contest in Shanghai. So this cosmopolitan allure adds to this symbolic exoticism. So in some ways, you can look at the Burmese film industry as perpetuating an aspect of Bama-formed Orientalism, where, okay, she's one of ours because she's Shan, but let's showcase her exoticism as part of that.
Now, you've raised the issue of ethnicity. It's well known that after independence in 1948, the Burmese government faced numerous ethnic separatist movements, but it's much less well known how the Burmese film industry tried to represent ethnic minorities in its films. And you deal with this issue in quite a bit of detail in the latter part of the book. The industry is, of course, dominated by ethnic Bamas, but in the films from this period, you discuss that there does seem to be a certain sensitivity, at least some occasions, to how the film industry represents ethnic minorities.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the other challenges about studying an industry that's so large, but also something that is so polyvocal, that you'll have some films that are very patronizing towards non-Bama people, presenting them as savages, presenting them as robbers, presenting them as primitives, or romanticizing them, and or having Bama ethnic characters playing people that are supposed to be ethnic minorities. For example, when I tell Shan friends about my book, oftentimes I'm met with this frustration, like, how come the bad guys, how come the robbers are always wearing Shan pants? And, you know, these little aspects of character, wardrobe and blocking are things that they notice and pay attention to. Or there'll be cases where it'll be a Bama man going to a, for example, there's a well-known film called Shan Piao Ede, Guests in Shanland, where a Bama soldier falls in love with a Shan woman while she's taking a bath in the river. And whether you see that as romantic or frightening depends on your subject positioning, but it's a common and a recurring trope in Burmese film. But also there are Burmese film directors, Bama film directors, that make a specific genre of movies. They call them Tayantai Yoshin, or ethnic films, as it were, in order to portray non-Bama stories in a sympathetic light. So there are patronizing films, there's insulting films, and there's sympathetic films. And so they really have to be treated in their respective contexts.
One of the big turning points in modern Burmese history is the military coup in 1962, led by General Ne Win, following which the military junta announces its policy to institute the so-called Burmese way to socialism. What effect did this political change have on filmmaking in Burma?
Well, to summarize that, General Ne Win's coup restructured the film industry both economically as well as ideologically. And so economically, in the sense that they took economic control over the industry, that they had government control, nationalized some of the cinemas, but still allowed filmmaking companies to exist as private entities. For example, if you're a film company and you wanted to make the film, you would have to submit your script to the censor board, pay a per page reading fee for the copies of that script. And then once it was approved, you would be allotted permission to buy, a license to buy a certain amount of raw footage, raw film, to go ahead and shoot your film, and then edit it, and then send it back to the censor board again for them to watch. And then you would be given a license to show the film in the cinema. And if it proved problematic, the censor board reserved the right to pull it from the cinemas as well. So it's creating this incentive for production companies to try to get the films through the censor board as quickly as possible and to stick to safe topics, because the censor board was given ideological right to cut any bits that were, I mean, the usual things like sinful things like gambling, sex, you know, scantily clad things, you know, women drinking, that sort of stuff would be cut, but also things that were not considered in line with the Burmese way to socialism. So a lot of it is up to the interpretation of the censor board, or they wanted to have films that would be useful for the Burmese way to socialism. I look at the remake as a bellwether to see what sort of aspects of remakes have changed during the Ne Win era. And you start to see a bit more socialist ideology put into the film. So it's not only about what the censor board takes away, but also what's added to please the censor board.
So the military regime imposes, by comparison with previous regimes, a heavy censorship regime on Burmese films. But you argue that film directors were able to adapt to this new political environment in innovative ways.
Well, I mean, bear in mind, too, that the people who populated the censor board, they were participants in the film industry as well. Sometimes they'd be filmmakers who, you know, would find themselves tapped on the shoulder to go and be a part of the censor board because the government decided to populate it with people who were film experts as well. And this is a really interesting question for social history of, you know, how does the censor board really work at the local level? And how did Burmese filmmakers work with the censor board? Because in the West, or especially among academics and artists, there's this notion that, oh, you have the artist fighting back and trying to avoid the stupid iron fist of the censor board, or, you know, this romantic rebel artist. But in fact, they often found ways to work with the censor board, or they would choose to produce things that the censor board would like. And in some rare cases, actually, the censor board would censor things that were problematic ethnically, or that could be seen as patronizing towards ethnic minorities. So there's a really fascinating dynamic that's much more than about the artist David fighting against the Goliath of the government. But there are some really fascinating stories that a director would tell me that they would call it ngasa, they'd call it like bait, that they'd put some scenes that they knew the censor board would cut, just to let them cut them so that they would feel that they're doing the job, but it wouldn't interfere with the rest of the story.
Your book covers a period 1920 to 1980. Why did you decide to stop in 1980?
First of all, it covers three major eras in Burmese history. So it's interesting to see how the industry changed as a whole across the colonial period, the parliamentary democracy period, and then finally the Ne Win socialist era. And also, thinking about film as the center, the mainstream of Burmese popular culture is important as well. I mean, cinema usurped the role of puppet shows and theater as the most popular entertainment form in Burma. And there's a useful theory written by media scholar David Thornburn describing television as a consensus narrative, in that it's something that everybody comes together to watch, but then also gives people small talk. It gives them conversations to have, and then gets people on the same page with the kinds of narratives that they'll talk about. And he looks at the process through which television in the United States took over the role of cinema as the consensus narrative. And so Burma didn't have television until 1979, 1980. So I'm really looking at this period over which cinema was really the center of its mainstream popular culture scene.
I know that your book has only just come out, but one of the questions I'd like to ask is whether you've had any feedback from your informants or colleagues in Burma about the book.
Oh, gosh. Well, I've had a lot of Burmese friends have been taking an interest in and have been encouraging the book for a long time, partially because they're well aware that people outside Burma don't know about Burmese cinema, that it's long been a point of cultural pride for them to talk about this industry. Again, there's so much nostalgia for the black and white era, and Myanmar television still shows these movies. You know, every Sunday they'll show these classic movies from the 1930s onwards. The big period of the 1960s, the 1970s, where you have characters like Win U and Kin Thanh Nu, and you know, these sexy cosmopolitan and deeply romantic movies as well, are things that are very much treasured and beloved by Burmese audiences. And for a lot of Burmese people, there's this frustration that there are very real political problems in the country. There is a massive and ongoing civil war in the country, and the economic problems and the political problems are, of course, real and very horrific. But there's other aspects to Burmese society and Burmese history as well. And this massive cinema industry, the fact that it hasn't had space in outside discourse or outside media about Burma, I think a lot of Burmese people or people that I've talked to have been frustrated that foreigners only see Burma as a place where people suffer, rather than as a place where people have incredible creativity, have a thriving literary scene, and have amazing senses of humor as well. So there's part of this hope that having a book about Burmese cinema will give readers a more rounded perspective of the country's history. And then also the fact that cinema both engages and is a reflection of what's going on in terms of the country's political economy and its culture, but also influences its political economy and its culture. So the book tries to engage these other aspects too by focusing on social history.
So you've been working on this project for quite a long time. You must be glad that it's finally come to completion. Do you have a new research project in the wings? And can you tell the listeners what it might be?
Oh, gosh. Yeah, I don't know right now. I got some other projects. I mean, I've always been very much a fan of and love to engage popular culture in general, or Burmese music. And Burmese cinema music is something that I want to continue to write about, but I don't have another cinema book plan on my plate at the moment. I'll see how this one goes. I still have a lot of books and magazines and different research that I continue to pursue. It's just a matter of finding something that has an arc of a story that'll make it into a book form. I'm not sure yet.
Jane Ferguson, thanks so much for joining us on this episode of New Books in Southeast Asian Studies to discuss your new book, Silver Screens and Golden Dreams, A Social History of Burmese Cinema. It's published by University of Hawaii Press this year.
Thank you so much for having me, Patrick. It's been a pleasure.
And you've been listening to New Books in Southeast Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. As always, thanks everyone for listening. If you're interested in this growing area of the study of film in Southeast Asia, particularly with a focus on gender, I'd recommend listening to some of our other podcasts on this subject. For example, Alicia Izzaruddin's Gender and Islam in Indonesian Cinema, published by Palgrave Press in 2017. Or Annika Furman's Ghostly Desires, Queer Sexuality and Vernacular Buddhism in Contemporary Thai Cinema, published by Duke University Press in 2016. You can download or stream these interviews and thousands more free of charge via the New Books Network website or iTunes.